Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Welcome to Thursday's edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm your host, Dave Allen. Melody taking care of other client business today. For all your gold and silver needs, call her toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you some opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day. Thursday, June 22, 2023. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, happy National Kissing Day. Yes, June 22nd encourages us to pucker up for a smooch. Whether the kiss comes from your significant other, your children, your grandchildren, your pets, share the love. Kiss has been part of our culture for thousands of years. Reasons we kiss vary, too. While affection and attraction may be the most common reason for kissing, the kiss has always been used as a greeting, too. In some culture, kissing a cheek dates back to Christian rituals. In Ireland, the custom of kissing the Blarney Stone has existed for centuries and is said to bestow the kisser with the gift of eloquence and persuasiveness. Another medieval tradition that hopefully has been extinguished is the practice of kissing the feet of royalty, or to those in power. A similar act of kissing includes kissing of the ring of, say, the Pope or someone else to show fealty, which leads to hand kissing. While this gesture suggests loyalty to someone, it has a friendlier connotation than that of kissing feet. For some, in fact, it's a sign of respect and affection. But National Kissing Day offers more than a history lesson. It encourages us to reconnect and draw closer to our loved ones. And whether it's a peck on the cheek or a passionate kiss when we receive one from someone we love, kissing brings sheer joy. Kissing triggers the release of endorphins, which in turn tells our brain it's happy. When we kiss, our anxiety is reduced, our blood pressure lowers too. Yes, those boo-hoo kisses from our mommies still carry some real power later in life. The big question is, have you kissed someone today? If not, do so. There's plenty of time left. So why don't we get to the market report for today. Precious metals not reacting kindly at all. Gold in the New York spot aftermarket down about 1%, $1,915. That is largely a reaction to the Fed and other central banks still leaning hawkish on monetary policies. Of course, that's bearish for precious metals, both from a demand perspective and as it makes competing government bonds more attractive with their bond yields rising. Now silver down 1.3% today at 22.45. Platinum down 2 1/3 percent at 9.31. And palladium down almost 5% at $1,318. U.S. dollar, not surprisingly, up about 0.34, a third of a percent, at 102.42, the U.S. dollar index. Other commodities, oil down big, over 4%, down below 70 again at 69.38 a barrel. Natural gas actually up a slight tad to $2.60. In the treasuries, again, unsurprisingly, all yields up today. 10-year yield up 0.07 to 3.8, we'll call it 3.8. The 2-year up 0.08, excuse me, at 4.8%. And the 3-month, unbelievable, this big inverted yield curve, that's basically flat, but slightly up at 5.3%. Now, in the paper markets, we have the Dow Jones fairly flat, closed down about 5 points, 33,947 it rounds to. NASDAQ up about a percent, 128 points at 13,631. And the broader S&P 500 up about a third of a percent, 16 points at 4,382. And that, ladies and gentlemen, calls it a day for today's market report brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Now, overseas, Bank of England surprised markets today with a 50 basis point hike to its interest rates. That's its 13th consecutive increase as its policymakers continue grappling with persistently high inflation. The bank's Monetary Policy Committee, the MPC, voted 7-2 in favor of the half percentage point increase, which takes the bank's base to, well, 5%, just a tad below where the Fed funds rate is. The move defied market expectations there, which had priced in around a 60% chance of a 25 basis point hike. Fresh data yesterday showed that the annual consumer price inflation in the UK was still 8.7% last month, that unchanged from April, cementing market expectations that the bank would opt for another hike, albeit half of what it ended up being. Economists also upped their expectations for further monetary tightening in the UK in the coming months. Now, most worrying for the BOE, core inflation, which again excludes the volatile energy, food, alcohol, and tobacco prices, was 7.1% on the year in May. That's up from 6.8% in April, its highest rate since March of 1992. BOE policymakers continue walking a tightrope as they attempt to tighten monetary policy enough to quell inflationary pressures without triggering a full-scale mortgage crisis and recession. Certainly, good luck with that, because it doesn't appear to be in the cards. The MPC said that the high number of fixed-rate mortgages there means that the full impact of this latest increase will not be felt for some time. Now, meanwhile, Turkey's central bank hiked interest rates to 15% in a dramatic turnaround in that country's fight against inflation. The Swiss National Bank opted for a smaller 25 basis point hike at its quarterly policy meeting today. That's its fifth straight increase since last June, taking its policy rate to 1.75%. Now, if you missed this yesterday, Fed Chair Jerome Powell affirmed in congressional testimony that more interest rates hikes are likely ahead here until additional progress is made on bringing down inflation. Speaking a week after Fed officials decided for the first time in more than a year to not push rates higher, Powell indicated that the move was likely just a brief respite rather than an indication that the Fed is done hiking. He said in prepared remarks to the House Financial Services Committee, nearly all FOMC participants, Federal Open Market Committee participants, expect that it will be appropriate to raise interest rates somewhat further by the end of the year. Now, after last week's two-day meeting, Fed officials indicated they see rate increases totaling another half of a percentage point through the end of this year. That would indicate two additional quarter point moves, with the Fed's benchmark borrowing rate now in a range between 5 and 5.25%. Noting that inflation has cooled but remains well above the Fed's 2% target, Powell said the Fed still has more work to do, saying inflation pressures continue to run high and the process of getting inflation back down to 2% has a long way to go. Fed officials, of course, generally prefer to look at core inflation as well, excluding food and energy prices, which is showing inflation in the States running at 4.7% as measured by the Fed's preferred index, the PCE, Personal Consumption Expenditures Index. Powell said the labor market here is still tight, though there are signs that conditions continue to loosen, such as an increase in the labor force participation, particularly in the prime 25 to 54 age group, and along with some moderating in wages recently. However, he noted that the number of open jobs still far exceeds the available labor pool. Inflation expectations, considered a key variable for where prices are heading over time, are well anchored, he added. The latest University of Michigan Consumer Confidence Survey, for instance, shows that the inflation outlook for a year from now has dipped to 3.3%. That's lowest since March of 21. Powell also emphasized that rate decisions are going to be made based on incoming data and meeting by meeting rather than on any preset course. And interestingly, in a human twist of fate, it turns out that the head of the Fed is also a deadhead. Since a photo emerged earlier this month of Powell at a Virginia performance of The Dead and Company, the Fed chair's fondness for the legends of San Francisco's psychedelia has been a point of mild amusement. Now, The Dead and Company is a project of former Grateful Dead members Mickey Hart, Bob Weir, and Bill Kreutzmann, as well as guitarist John Mayer and others. Powell has made no bones about it when asked during his testimony yesterday. It's all true, he said. He was indeed at the show. What can I say? He said. It was great. I've been a Grateful Dead fan for 50 years. The chair reportedly attended his first Dead concert in 1973 at RFK Stadium in Washington. Now, that is something you can take to the bank. The central bank, that is. There, Jerome Powell. Hey, the Senate Banking Committee has voted to send to the full Senate a bill that aims to hold banking execs accountable after the collapse of several big banks back in March. The Recovering Executive Compensation from Unaccountable Practices Act, known as RECOOP, cleverly, would give regulators power to claw back compensation from executives of failed banks, institute penalties for misconduct, and direct banks to beef up corporate governance. Now, members voted 21-2 to pass the measure out of committee. Senators Sherrod Brown, committee chair, and ranking member Tim Scott announced an agreement on that legislation last week. Brown happens to be up for re-election next year, and Scott's running for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination. The Recoup bill aims to allow regulators to remove senior banking executives who demonstrate misconduct in oversight, including failures to apply risk controls and breaches of fiduciary duty. It would also give regulators the discretion to ban these executives from the industry, taking these decisions out of the hands of their boards of directors. Wonder how Jamie Dimon at JPMorgan Chase is sleep tonight. Now, it would also give regulators the discretion to ban these executives entirely from the industry. It would boost regulatory control over penalties for executives who break the law and increase the maximum penalty for the worst violations, and would allow the bank's board or the FDIC to call back, that is, take back compensation an executive received in the 2 years before a bank's failure. Interesting development there. We'll see what happens, and we'll keep you in the loop as to what happens with the full Senate, and of course later on, in the House. Up until a few weeks ago, Dan Pombo, too big to fail, J.P. Morgan's global head of restructuring, thought a soft landing wasn't possible. Now, however, he's coming around to the idea that it may actually happen. Wall Streeters and others who work in debt restructuring and distressed investing tend to be some of the biggest skeptics of feel-good economic narratives. The most attuned to things that could go wrong and usher in a wave of debt defaults. After all, a default cycle is when these folks have the most opportunities to make money by advising companies in trouble or investing in their debt at pennies on the dollar. Pombo notes, a few weeks ago, I would have said, yeah, we're definitely heading into a recession, but I'm not sure anymore. Consumers aren't pulling back on their spending. Wall Streeter's view on high-yield bond default rates is that they'll climb to about 3.25% next year. That's higher than today's 2.4%, but in the realm of the long-term historical average of 3.2. And Pombo agrees with that forecast. He sees defaults and bankruptcies ticking up further as a result of higher interest rates rather than widespread economic pain due to a recession. Pombo shift in thinking shows up in high-yield bond spreads, too. Average spreads, which, of course, are the amount that corporate borrowers have to pay over Treasury yields, shot up shockingly fast after Silicon Valley Bank's collapse to levels that typically indicate recession risk. And we'll see what happens. Lots of luck with that perspective, Pombo. Key headwinds for gold surrounds the outlook for corporate profits right now, which by some measures is actually looking better these days. It's one of the reasons the bulls of the paper market appear to have the bears on the run at the moment. Since the last round of earnings started arriving in mid-April, Wall Streeters have been marking up their expectations for the profits of S&P companies what they're likely to generate over the coming year. Now, in the aggregate, analysts have upped their estimates by about 3% to nearly $232 a share for the entire market from just below $225 back when worries about an imminent recession were arguably at their worst earlier this year. Analysts now expect the S&P 500 to deliver another year of record earnings in 2023, with earnings per share rising roughly 2% to a little over $220 by the end of December. That's according to FactSet. Now, granted, that's not huge growth, but it seems to be enough for some Wall Streeters to give stocks a firm foundation to climb. Now, after the break, which starts right now, we'll talk about the outlook for gold. Stick around. We'll be back after these messages. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home. And if you ask me how I'm feeling, don't tell me you're too blind to see. Never gonna give you up, never gonna let you down, never gonna run around and desert you, never gonna make you cry, never gonna say goodbye, never gonna tell a lie. And welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody taking care of other business matters today. Call the office 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday at 1-800-375-4188. Or check out our website, dgscoins.com. While you're there, sign up for our weekly newsletters and blogs. Again, dgscoins.com. Well, it's time for our weekly segment, Levity is Golden. Today's topic is, well, the best and worst places in the world to live. Every year, the Economist Intelligence Unit ranks the best places to live in the Global Livability Index. This year, its index includes 172 cities with rankings based on a number of categories, usual characters, stability, healthcare, culture, education, and infrastructure. And for the second year in a row, Vienna, Austria has been named the best city to live in the entire world. The authors of the report calls Vienna out for its winning combination of stability, good culture and entertainment, reliable infrastructure, and exemplary education and health services. There are few downsides to living in Vienna, they say. One of them happens to be a lack of major sporting events. But beyond that, if you've happened to visit there, you may just want to stay. The same is true of Copenhagen, Denmark, which comes in next on the list for the second year in a row. Melbourne and Sydney, Australia took the third and fourth spots. The authors say the Australian cities, which bounced up and down during the pandemic, are now in third and fourth place. They've seen their scores in the healthcare category improve since last year, when they were still affected by COVID waves that stressed their healthcare systems. Well, the rest of the top 10 includes three Canadian cities, Vancouver, Calgary, and Toronto, two Swiss cities, Zurich and Geneva, and one in Japan, Osaka. What about the U.S.? Well, this year, the U.S. didn't quite crack the list of 10 best cities to live, but two U.S. cities, L.A. and San Diego, were among the cities making the biggest declines year to year. The report said these cities have not seen a particularly sharp decline in their index scores, but they failed to make the gains that many other cities, particularly in Asia, have made. As a result, they've been overtaken. Now, the highest ranked U.S. city was Atlanta, coming in at number 26 on the overall list, making it the best city to live in the U.S., but only the 26th best place to live in the world. Next up was Washington, D.C. at 29 and Honolulu at 30. Pittsburgh at number 36 and L.A. rounding out the top five for the U.S. Now, some of the biggest changes this year, the cities in Asia Pacific, eight of the top 10 cities happen to move up in the rankings are in this region. As to the five worst places to live right now, according to the report, they are, in this order, number five, Karachi, Pakistan; number four, Lagos, Nigeria; three, Algiers, Algeria; two, Tripoli, Libya; and the number one worst city to live in is war-torn Damascus, Syria. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is this week's Levity is Golden. Now, here's two stories that I briefly mentioned the first segment about the outlook for gold this year and the next few. The global precious metals market will breach $403 billion by 2028 and be led by the gold sector. It's according to India-based consultancy firm Fortune Business Insights, FBI. That's up from 2021's $275 billion. Between 21 and 28, the precious metal market compound annual growth is estimated by them to be at 5.6%. The FBI says gold will play a vital role in the growth of the precious metals market. Excuse me. The increasing investments in a commodity such as gold due to its low risk factor compared to other investments such as equities, bonds, or real estate are fueling the market. Continuing, the firm added, pardon me, the perception of gold as a status symbol and safe haven for investment has significantly contributed to the growth of the market. As to avoid the risk, investors regularly flock towards gold as an asset that will continue to maintain its value. The investment side is projected to be the fastest growing segment between 2021 and 28. According to the report, the increasing investments in a commodity such as gold, due to its low risk factor compared to other investments, are augmenting this segment growth. Now, the report also highlighted jewelry demand as one of the key drivers. Increasing disposable incomes and changing lifestyle choices are just a few of the factors driving that market. The demand for these metals is estimated to propel globally for jewelry and investment applications, as gold and silver are of prime importance in wedding ceremonies of Southeast Asian countries. Oh, sorry, ladies and gentlemen, I got a feather in my throat. Therefore, the report adds, the rise in population and increasing spending capacity of consumers in the region, particularly India and China, will contribute to market growth. Silver, it says, is the metal that will benefit the most from the expanding electrical and electronics industry. And in the meantime, platinum group metals will be driven
by auto catalyst applications. Plus, the automotive industry is the major consumer of platinum and palladium, with the primary application in the catalytic converter. Now, not all research firms share as optimistic an outlook. The IMARC group said that global precious metal market reached $198.5 billion last year and is set to expand to $267.5 billion by 2028. And Research Reports World estimates the global precious metal markets to reach $316.6 billion in 2030. Now, in that second story, emerging central banks are gearing up for a new monetary regime where gold will play a vital role as a settlement mechanism. This, according to Gehring and Rosenzweig. The U.S. dollar might be on the verge of losing its reserve status, currency status, GNR Managing Director Lee Gehring said. A change in the dollar's reserve currency status, he said, would be the most impactful market shock of the last 40 years. Recently, central banks around the world have stepped up their gold allocation, boosting their own reserves, led by emerging economies primarily, like China, India, Turkey, Egypt, Qatar, and Singapore. After last year's record amount of 1,136 tons purchased, central banks added 228 tons to their gold reserves during the first quarter this year. Gehring said this aggressive gold buying is keeping gold supported above the 1,900 an ounce level in the face of such a hawkish Fed. He said, we'll break through the triple top that we put in place at the 2,000 an ounce level. We will blow through it, and the central bank buying will be the big push. World Gold Council data show that central banks have not only been a huge source of global demand in the last 2 years, but they're also the driving force for this whole decade. And this could be connected to a monetary regime change that Gehring and Rosenzweig is forecasting. Again, Gehring says the monetary regime changes in 1930, 1968, 1998 were hugely stimulative for commodity prices. And we believe the monetary regime change that will take place this decade will be no different. The idea that the dollar is losing its reserve currency status has existed for years. We talk about it a lot on this program, but it's been largely nothing but a lot of noise. So what makes this time different? Well, for one thing, there's a growing amount of evidence that certain countries are moving away from the greenback. Saudi Arabia talking about settling their oil and renminbi and all Russian oil sales, sanctioned oil sales, being paid in renminbi. Brazil wants to settle its agricultural trade with China in renminbi. And France's Total Energies is willing to sell their liquid natural gas to China and accept it as well. Kitco's Anna Golubova says these efforts can't be classified as a monetary regime change just yet because China's got a closed capital account and the country's trading in renminbi can't exchange it. Where gold comes in. How in the world would you ever be able to exchange renminbi? Gehring asks. Answering, they're talking about eventually settling it all up with gold, adding that any move by China to displace the dollar as a reserve currency must include some degree of gold convertibility. Foreign holders could then convert some portion of their trade surplus from renminbi into gold via the Shanghai Gold Exchange. Is this why all these central banks are buying gold these days? Well, we know China's certainly gotten serious about increasing its reserves, buying gold for the seventh straight month in May. In fact, since last November, China's purchased 144 tons of gold. And the People's Bank of China total stockpiles now reported close to 2,100 tons. By the way, Gehring and Rosenzweig bullish on gold the rest of this year. projecting a breakthrough $2,100. Think your cooling bills are sky high? Texas power prices literally doubled on Tuesday as record high temperatures in parts of the state sent demand for cooling there soaring. By the evening, power cost about $5,000 per megawatt hour, up from $2,500 earlier in the day. That's according to the state grid operator, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, known as ERCOT. On Tuesday, St. Angelo in western Texas set a new record high temp of 114 degrees. And in the Rio Grande Valley, Del Rio hit a new high of 113. Meanwhile, Dallas and San Antonio also set new records for this time of year. Added to the demand on Texas power supplies and prices, the tropical level humidity in the state that worsens the heat effect, making it feel like 120 degrees or more. Well, the heat wave's expected to last longer than a week, meaning the power grid will be under extended strain. It's a wonder that so many Americans have been flocking from other regions of the country to this boilerama of a state since the heydays of the pandemic. Hey, it's Jobless Claims Thursday. Did you think I forgot? Well, the number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits remained elevated last week. Potentially another sign that the Fed rate hikes are beginning to cool a surprisingly resilient labor market. Applications for first-time claims were 264,000 for the week ending June 17th, the same as the previous week's revised number. That's according to the Labor Department out today with these numbers. And numbers for the past 2 weeks are the highest since October 2021. The four-week moving average of claims, which smooths out some of the week-to-week volatility, rose by 8,500. It's a lot. To about $255,750, the highest since November 2021. The jobless claims in the past 3 weeks have pushed closer and closer to 300,000 after mostly being in the high 100 to low 200,000 range since the fall of 21. But that's unlikely not enough for the Fed, who've said in the past that the unemployment rate needs to rise well past 4% to bring inflation down. Analysts are reluctant to take the recent rise in benefit applications at face value after fraudulent claims in some states elevated numbers for a few weeks earlier this year. And sales of previously occupied homes edged higher in May, and the national median price posted its biggest annual drop in more than a decade, even as the supply of available properties sank to an all-time low. Existing home sales rose 0.2% last month over April. Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. To a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 4.3 million. That's according to the National Association of Realtors. But sales sank over 20% compared with May last year. That marks 10 consecutive months of annualized sales declines of 20% or more. The annual drop was the steepest in markets across the West and Northeast, where sales slumped more than 25%. The national median home price fell 3.1% for May last year to $396,100. According to the realtors, that's the biggest decline since December 2011, when the housing market was still on the mend following the housing bust. The latest housing market figures are more evidence that even with prices declining after heading higher for more than a decade, many house owners are being held back by a persistently low inventory of homes for sale. All told, there were just about 1.1 million homes in the market at the end of May. It's an increase of almost 4% from April, but down 6% from a year earlier. It's the fewest homes for sale on record, going all the way back to 1999. number of homes on the market at the end of May amounts to a three-month supply at current sales prices, a 15% improvement over 2.6 months in May a year ago. But normally, normal balance market between buyers and sellers, there's a 5 to 6 month supply. Hey, by the way, 30-year loan down to 6.67%. That music means it's time for another short break. We'll be back in a few short minutes. Please stick around. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSCTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. For all your precious metal needs, call us at 1-800-375-4188. Hey, the Fed may have paused its aggressive interest rate hikes for now, but that offers little relief for anyone with credit card debt. Yes, the Fed has raised rates 10 times since last March, the fastest pace of tightening since the early 80s, and that, of course, has caused credit card rates to hit an all-time high. Ted Rossman at Bankrate tells CNBC News' Jessica Stickler, even though the Fed has hit the pause button on its rate hiking campaign, the cumulative effect is significant. Since most credit cards have a variable rate, there's a direct connection to the Fed's benchmark. And as the Fed funds rate has risen, the prime rate has as well, and credit card rates have followed suit. In fact, the average credit card now charges a record 20.69%. 20.69%. Four times the amount of what banks, the Fed charges its member banks. Nearly 5 percentage points higher than the beginning of last year.
Michelle Ranieri, a VP at TransUnion, says while the skip, the Fed skip, means interest rates may not rise again this month, the high credit card interest rates consumers are currently seeing are going nowhere anytime soon. Sky-high APRs make credit cards one of the most expensive ways to borrow money from month to month, and yet many Americans continue to take on ever-increasing amounts of that type of debt. While balances are higher, nearly half of credit card holders carry credit card debt from month to month, according to Bankrate. Greg McBride, who's a chief financial analyst there, says paying down high-cost variable-rate debt is an urgent priority for households. Most experts often recommend moving that balance from a high-rate credit rate credit card to one with no interest or low interest balance transfer offer to reduce the amount of interest you pay. Rossmann's top tip, in fact, is to sign up for a zero balance transfer card, which allows you to avoid interest in many cases for up to 21 months. While those offers may be a little harder to find right now than they were a year ago, the good news, he says, is that you can still get balance transfer credit cards, assuming you have good credit, and they can save you a ton of money. Matt Schultz, who is chief credit analyst at LendingTree, adds they are still about the best weapon you can have in your debt arsenal. To make the most of a balance transfer, he recommends aggressively paying down the balance during the introductory period. Otherwise, there could be a catch. If you don't pay the balance off during the initial period, the remaining balance will have a new annual percentage rate applied to it, which is generally 23% on average, even higher than the rates for new credit. Further, there can be limits on how much you can transfer, as well as fees attached. Most cards do have a one-time balance transfer fee, usually about 3%. Of the tab, but look out, there can be an annual fee as well. And remember, just one late payment can negate your no interest offer. If you're expecting or know someone who is, you should know that a new federal law protecting the rights of pregnant workers will take effect on June 27th. Pregnant Workers Fairness Act is a major advancement for the rights of pregnant workers for first in more than 40 years and has the potential, analysts say, to increase women's labor force participation over the long term. The law signed by President Biden at the end of last year requires employers with more than 15 employees to provide reasonable accommodations to pregnant workers as well as those recovering from childbirth and those who need to pump breast milk at work. For example, a pregnant warehouse worker might need light duty if a doctor has restricted the amount of weight the employee can lift for several weeks. And a retail worker might need extra bathroom breaks, say, or have to carry a bottle of water on the store floor. The cashier might have to ask to sit on a stool while working. Pregnant workers typically need time off to go to the doctor, or if they wear uniforms at work, they'll need new clothes. Employers can claim a hardship exemption if they truly can't make any accommodation work. Over the years, women have filed numerous lawsuits over issues like these, often losing to employers because the 1978 Pregnancy Discrimination Act doesn't explicitly mandate accommodations. Even a Supreme Court decision in 2015 that was initially viewed as a victory for pregnant workers has had little impact. As a result, pregnant workers, particularly those in lower wage industries who work almost exclusively on their feet, have often been forced out of their jobs, and that cut them off from earning money right before a new baby enters their lives, a time when it's harder to look for new work and when they need, particularly single mothers, need the new money, need the money the most. Others wind up sticking it out, though, ignoring doctor orders and putting their and their baby's health at risk, often with severe consequences. About 3 million women a year are estimated to be pregnant on the job. That's 70% of all pregnant women in the U.S.
according to the National Partnership for Women and Families. In other words, the new law has the potential to keep millions of women attached to the workforce and comes as the U.S. lags behind other countries in women's labor force participation. The law, it turns out, may also effectively be a backdoor expansion of maternity leave in the U.S. That's because workers can request leave to recover from childbirth, even those who don't qualify for unpaid leave under the Family and Medical Leave Act. The new law would cover many more workers than the FMLA, which has a 50-worker minimum and other restrictions. Under the new law, workers can also ask for time off to recover from a miscarriage, postpartum depression, mastitis, or other pregnancy-related health issues. Now, October 1st may seem like an eternity, particularly to summer beachgoers, but it's coming faster than you can say student loan pause ending. It's okay, I'll take the bait. Student loan pause ending. Well, because officially it's true. After 3 years of the U.S. Department of Education crying wolf and telling borrowers their monthly bills were set to start back up after some pandemic relief, only to have President Biden take it back and provide them more time, this time the agency really means it. No, really. The Education Department recently posted on its website, ed.gov, that payments will be due starting in October. And the recent debt ceiling deal between Congress and the White House, which was signed into law earlier this month, will make changing that plan another guaranteed lawsuit. It will certainly be a big adjustment for most borrowers when the pandemic-era policy expires. Around 40 million Americans have debt from their education, with the typical monthly bill averaging around $350. Persis Yu at the Student Borrower Protection Center says for many borrowers, the payment pause has literally been life-altering. It's saved many from outright financial ruin and has allowed others to finally catch up and, in some instances, even get a little ahead financially. Former President Trump first announced the hiatus on federal student loan payments, including the accrual of interest, in March 2020, when COVID hit the nation hard. The pause has been extended 8 times since then. Excuse me. Virtually everyone eligible for the relief has taken advantage of it, with less than 1% of qualifying borrowers continuing to make payments on their education debt. Higher education analyst Mark Kantrowitz estimates that because of the pauses, the average student loan borrower has likely saved around $15,000 in payments. In exchange for voting to increase the government's $31.4 trillion debt limit, Republicans demanded large cuts to federal spending. They sought to repeal Biden's executive action granting student loan forgiveness, but the administration refused to agree to that. However, a compromise provision in the deal to suspend the debt limit until after the 2024 presidential election officially terminates the pause at the end of August. Even before the agreement was consummated, the Biden administration had been preparing borrowers for their payments to resume. At a recent hearing, Education Secretary Miguel Cardona told senators the emergency period is over and we're preparing our borrowers to restart. The Education Department says borrowers will be required to make their first post-pause payment in October. But interest will start accumulating on borrowers' debt again on September 1st. Exact due dates will vary based on a borrower's individual account, Kantrowitz said. Your due date will be at least 21 days after you're sent your next loan statement. As the Biden administration tries to prime millions of borrowers to restart their payments, there are two big unanswered questions that may make that a problem. One, most borrowers don't know what they'll owe come this fall because, well, the Supreme Court has yet to issue its verdict on the validity of Biden's plan to cancel up to $20,000 in student debt for borrowers. A decision probably to overturn the president's decision, but not definitely as expected, but not guaranteed by the end of this month, although some are now saying it could wait until the court's next term in October. Well, regardless of the court decision, no one knows what will happen if new Republican demands for deeper spending cuts beyond what was agreed to at the debt ceiling negotiations result in a government shutdown on October 1st, as some are now anticipating. Because the vast majority of Education Department employees, including those who administer student loans, are considered non-essential, well, they'd likely be furloughed in the event of a shutdown. While estimates vary, most experts believe that around 37 million people would be eligible for some loan cancellation under Biden's executive order. Roughly a third of those with federal student loans, about 14 million, would have their balances entirely forgiven by the president's program. As a result, they wouldn't owe anything come October. For those who still have a balance after the relief, the Education Department has said it plans to re-amortize borrowers' lower debt. That means it will recalculate people's monthly payment based on their lower tab and the number of months they have left on their repayment timeline. For example, if a person owes, say, $30,000 in student loans at a 5% interest rate, well, before the pandemic, they would have paid around $320 a month on a 10-year repayment term. If forgiveness happens to be okayed by the court and that person gets, say, $10,000 in loan forgiveness, their total balance due would be reduced by a third and their monthly payment would drop by a third to about $210 a month. Now, on the one hand, critics of the Biden order say it's just patently unfair to the millions of borrowers who faithfully paid off their loan balances in the past, not to mention the taxpayers as a whole who would be left holding the, quote, tab. Other opponents say a blanket forgiveness program is just bad public policy, that it should have at least been means tested so that only borrowers with lower or the lowest incomes would have been eligible. On the other hand, Education Department Undersecretary James Cavall recently warned that if the courts overturn Biden's loan forgiveness program, delinquency and default rates could skyrocket. Cavall said borrowers who are in danger of defaulting the most are those for whom Biden's policy would have wiped out their balance entirely. He noted, unless the department is allowed to provide one-time student loan debt relief, we expect this group of borrowers to have higher loan default rates due to the ongoing confusion about what they owe. Well, let's put it this way, ladies and gentlemen. However you feel about the Biden executive order and what the Supreme Court decision ought to rule, it's certainly a conundrum that even with direction from the nation's highest court won't be completely or perhaps even significantly resolved for quite a while longer, if in fact ever. And that is all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back next Tuesday. Melody, I'll be back tomorrow with Butch to close out another week. Also, be on the lookout for our weekly What a Rush of Gold and Silver blog in your email inboxes in the morning. Thanks as always to our production engineer, Todd Waite, and to you for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Have a good night. Bye-bye. There never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.